This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Patrick Lynch. He's the author and illustrator of a fantastic book called A Field Guide to Long Island Sound. You know, being in Connecticut, Long Island Sound is one of the major features of our lives. But for people who are listening who may not be so aware of the location and meaning of Long Island Sound, maybe, Pat, you could talk a little bit about. I mean, one of the things you said first, earliest in the book that really I thought was important was to identify Long Island Sound as an estuary environment, which I think is something that people don't really realize. It's just a big body of water that looks like the ocean. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the estuarine quality, what that means for the whole, the way we think about this, the sound itself.
Sure. Well, Long Island Sound is a sound, which is a literal definition, is a body of water that's open at both ends. The sound is open, of course, on the eastern end, out near Fisher's Island and what they call the Race. And it's also open to the East River down in New York City. And the East River is not actually a river. It's a tidal channel between the Long Island Sound and New York Harbor. So that's a sound. Long Island Sound is an estuary, and that's a little bit difficult for people to grasp sometimes. People know about the ocean, big waves, right, etc. Long Island Sound is a little bit different in that we have Long Island itself as a breakwater, so there's not usually big waves in Long Island Sound. And the Long Island Sound, the water is different. It's a little bit greener than ocean water. And people sometimes really don't know what to make of it. It's not quite the ocean. It's not fresh water. It's something in between. And it's important to understand that that something in between is actually quite unique and very important in that it is the ideal sort of nursery for a lot of things that we care about. Most of our food fish, game fish, if you're into fishing and stripers and bluefish and all that stuff, it all comes from the sound as an estuary. An estuary is a mixing of salt water and fresh water, and estuaries are extraordinarily biologically rich.
Yeah, because any environment that combines two major features, it kind of creates this friction, and that creates, adds to the richness.
Sure, you could think of Long Island Sound, among other things, as a giant nursery for these food fish, game fish that we appreciate.
Shellfish as well.
Yeah, shellfish.
Birds.
just all kinds of things. So the salt marshes, particularly on the Connecticut side, are incredibly rich. Salt marshes are beautiful to look at, but they're also second only to tropical rainforests in terms of biologic productivity. So there's an enormous amount of life out there in Long Island Sound that is different than the ocean, different than a freshwater lake or a river. It's something in between, but the something in between is extraordinarily vital.
And you talk about the rivers, the number of rivers that, the major rivers, obviously, that flow into the sound have their own environments in the, you know, specific to the each one of them, in a way. You know, the Connecticut River is different than the Housatonic, but, I mean, similar because they're both the estuaries of large river flows. But one of the other things you talked about that I thought was important to point out is the degree of risk and danger to this health of Long Island Sound. I mean, how bad it, I mean, it's already been damaged significantly. But it, you know, one of the things I thought about was that in the earlier years, prior to, let's say, the 70s, when the EPA came about and we started becoming more aware of industrial pollution, those rivers carried tremendous amounts of waste, industrial waste, human waste. Now they are cleaner. The rivers are cleaner. But the sound continues to be threatened. And I think you you kind of alluded to that, and that is the just the density of population, which is a significant element in talking about the sound today.
Sure. Any body of water that is surrounded by 9 million people is going to have challenges. And Long Island Sound, certainly if you went back 40, 50 years ago, was really staggering under the load of our indifference to what we dump into rivers and streams and sewage systems, etc. The sound is enormously cleaner today than it was in those past decades. And I like to emphasize the positive in all of this. Long Island Sound, in terms of its biological productivity, is as productive as it ever was, maybe more so now in significant dimensions in terms of wildlife and things like that. As I said, it's a lot cleaner. States, towns, cities have been literally cleaning up their act. The sound still faces significant challenges, particularly from nitrogen. That sounds a little exotic. Nitrogen's an element. It's very, very important in any kind of biological system. And the first thing to know about nitrogen is that it's a fertilizer. It's essential to life. And therefore, in a normal wild system, it's actually pretty scarce. Organisms take it up constantly because they need it to build the fundamental building blocks of proteins and other biological compounds. And when you introduce an artificially large supply of nitrogen, as we do in even treated wastewater and untreated sources of pollution that eventually flow into rivers and then Long Island Sound, you distort the biological system in ways that can make it quite unhealthy. For example, in the western part of the Sound, down near New York, what they call the narrows of the Sound, the sheer biological load of all that nitrogen produces enormous algae blooms in the warmer months of the year. Now, people know algae are plants, even the little marine plants that are out in Long Island Sound. And plants, when they photosynthesize, produce oxygen, which is good. But when you have enormous volumes, artificially large volumes of algae, when the sun goes down, they don't produce oxygen. They start using oxygen like the rest of living things. And they can use up so much of the oxygen in Long Island Sound that you get a condition called hypoxia. That is, the dissolved oxygen in the water drops to dangerously low levels, and we start getting things like large fish kills and stuff like that. Hypoxia is still a problem July, August, September in the narrows part of the Sound. Most of the rest of the Sound does not have severe hypoxia problems. There's been some interesting research done by UConn in the past few years looking at what happens in small harbors and river mouths and stuff like that, where there are sort of micro examples, that is micro in terms of a much smaller target area of just a harbor or just a particular river, in terms of hypoxia. So it's still a concern. But I like to emphasize the positive about Long Island Sound. It's enormously cleaner and healthier than it's been in centuries. And it's a spectacular biological resource in all kinds of dimensions. The fact that it's much cleaner now means that we now have historically much smaller than it was, but we have oyster industries again.
Right.
So that's nice to see. We have humpback whales and bottlenose dolphins and other things appearing regularly in the Sound in the last few years, not only because it's a lot cleaner, but because there's larger amounts of food fish and things. They come in looking for alewives and menhaden, what fishermen call bunker. So in many ways, the Sound is not a struggling environment at all.
Although you still have to be concerned about it.
Yes. It doesn't mean we should be indifferent to it, But when people look at the sand and the water's a little bit greener, the waves are smaller, the beaches are brown, not white like you see in commercials for Florida or whatever, and they think of the sand as somehow the poorer stepsister the real beaches.
I think there is that kind of unfortunate measurement that people make that you don't have surf.
So yeah, let's take it point by point. We're never going to have big surf like Musquamicut or whatever, right, because it's Long Island Sound is not exposed to the ocean. We have these wonderful breakwaters of Long Island and Fisher's Island, et cetera, Orient Point. And so the water is calmer. The water is greener a lot of times because it's so biologically productive, that notion of the estuary again.
And it's shallower.
Yes, it is shallower as well. So you're not going to see certain kinds of ocean fish and other things coming into the sound because they prefer a deeper environment.
Right.
But on the other hand, as I say, the sound is an extraordinarily productive nursery, particularly on the Connecticut side. We have these very extensive salt marshes and other things, which are the nursery places for the crabs and food fish and other kinds of things that we value.
One of the things that I think is hard for people, if, you know, with beaches, you go and you swim and you have the ocean experience, marshes are not accessible to average, you know, we don't just hang out in marshes.
Mm-hmm.
So that may also help explain the sort of lack of understanding or accept, you know, or recognition of the beauty of the sound, you know, and maybe in a way that's what this book is really about. I think the sound is incredibly beautiful, and salt marshes are, to me, one of the high points of my life, to be around them and near them. And I think they're beautiful, but also incredibly complex ecosystems. But I think, you know, the ability for the average person to spend time in a marsh is limited.
One of the challenging things about Long Island Sound is not so much that it's polluted or something like that. It's actually in fairly good shape in most dimensions. One problem with appreciating the sound is how little of it is accessible. Now, depending on how you count islands and river mouths and stuff like that in terms of determining shoreline area, only about 5-7% of Long Island Sound is accessible to the general public at what I would call a reasonable price. That is, public parks, state parks, etc., where you can drive, anybody can drive up at any time of year and pay a reasonable fee to get in. Only 5-7%. So it's another reason why I think the sound has been this almost kind of stealth environment, in the sense that people get glimpses of it from time to time, but most people don't have a lot of exposure to
it.
Right,
and we should say, for people who are not familiar with Connecticut, almost every town has a private beach. Well, public beach for them if you live in the town, but private if you do not live in the town. Or I think by law now they're forced to give access to people who don't live there, but they're allowed to charge exorbitant fees to keep their beaches as unused by the public as possible. So we have this kind of, you know, in some parts of America, the beaches are, the shoreline is much more available to the public than it is in Connecticut.
Sure, because of Connecticut and New York's history and the way private shorelines are organized now, it's the Long Island Sound is surrounded by some of the most beautiful and expensive real estate in the world. But unfortunately, that makes it not very accessible to people. As you say, town beaches can charge whatever they want in the summertime. Basically, they charge so much that although they're obligated to allow any of the public in, they can charge $50, $75, whatever, and nobody's going to pay that to go to the beaches. So effectively, those beaches are off limits to most of those 9 million people who live around the sound. And that's unfortunate. I think in the future, as we struggle with problems of sea level rise and climate change and things, I suspect that this New England, New York system of very private, very exclusive beaches is going to break down. If for nothing else, then an awful lot of the existing shoreline is going to flood.
Right. And the cost of rebuilding homes.
Sure, and the public in general is going to have to figure out how to respond to that. It's not an option. It will happen. We've got to figure out how we deal with the sea level rise, because it's going to have not only an enormous impact on shoreline homeowners and the public's perception of Long Island Sound, it is going to figure out how to phrase this. It is going to challenge our notion of how to manage a shoreline, which is very actively changing in human lifetimes. I mean, the sea level has been rising since the end of the glacial period, the most recent glacial period, about, 15,000 years ago. So sea level rise is nothing new. It's the enormously fast rate of sea level rise that's going to cause problems over the next century. And we're going to have to figure out how to differently manage a shoreline, which is changing all the time, changing practically as you watch it. So that's a little bit different for people to grasp, is you think of Long Island Sound, probably you have a picture of a map in your mind, and your notion is that maps don't change that much. Well, in the next century, they're going to change a lot.
Well, and if the sea level rises as significant as it has most recently been predicted, I think that means Long Island itself will be underwater to a great extent.
Worst case scenarios for sea level rise over the next century keep changing. It used to be that the worst case scenario was about 6 feet of sea level rise. Every year that creeps up. Yeah. It's now over 8 feet of sea level rise over the next century. That's the worst case scenario. The average sort of scenario as climate scientists make these calculations is probably more like 5 or 6 feet. Now, 5 or 6 feet of vertical rise is still enormous, because that could be a quarter mile, a half mile of horizontal rise.
Yeah.
So it's going to have an enormous impact on our shoreline and low-lying towns. In terms of the sound and its environments, probably the biggest impact that I worry about, lots of biologists worry about, is that those beautiful salt marshes, for example, are going to flood.
Right. And they'll change. It takes a long time for salt marshes to reform. It could conceivably happen. Where I live in Stratford, there's a salt marsh restoration project, and you can see a significant change in 2 or 3 years. So you could imagine, rate of change is critical to the biological health of any environment, because the adaptation speed is not as great. You know, species don't change quickly when conditions change. So that's another concern. What do you think about the water temperature of the sound as well? It seems like that would be a significant factor for an enclosed body of water.
Sure. The primary way that is noticeable to most people, I think, about Long Island Sound, the primary way that Long Island Sound has responded to recent climate change is it's gotten significantly warmer. Now, it's only a few degrees warmer than it used to be, but if you had to heat up the trillions of gallons of Long Island Sound, a few degrees would require an enormous input of energy. And so 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit may not seem like a lot, but it makes a tremendous difference to the biology of Long Island Sound. The sound is effectively becoming... it's heading toward more like a Chesapeake Bay right now.
Yes,
so
right.
We lost our lobster fishery over the last 20 years. Many people don't realize that. You can still go to the shoreline, you can have a lobster roll, etc. what people may not realize
is lobster's that, not coming from
yeah,
here.
The lobster's not coming from anywhere near Long Island Sound. It's coming from the Gulf of Maine or even further north,
right,
where lobsters are doing okay. The lobster is a cold water animal. The thing to understand about the loss of lobsters in Long Island Sound is that Long Island Sound was always the southern limit of inshore lobsters. That is, you know, in conventional lobstering with lobster pots and stuff like that, is done in relatively shallow water, no more than about 50 feet. Long Island Sound was always the southern limit of that. So it only took 1 or 2 degrees of difference for lobsters not to become a viable commercial fishery. Now, lobsters are not extinct in Long Island Sound. There's still some lobsters out there. There's just not enough of them to support a commercial fishery. Right.
And they go to colder water.
Sure.
So they're less accessible. Which,
yes, exactly. Yeah. So they prefer cold water. They really hyperventilate and stress out at about 65 to 68 degrees. So they are now in deeper water than they used to be in Long Island Sound, and there are many fewer of them, just because the sound is too warm. On the other hand, blue crab populations are exploding. So that's what I meant about the sound is getting not quite like, but a little bit more like Chesapeake Bay.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a really interesting, yeah.
So what's the take-home message here? Things change. In many cases, it seems sad, given the history, that we've lost a major fishery like lobsters. But the sound overall is as biologically productive as it ever was. It's just that things are changing. That biological productivity is now in terms of millions of blue crabs, not lobster anymore. So you see those kinds of effects all the time. Warmer water fishes are moving into the sound in greater numbers than there used to be. Some of things like winter flounder and whatnot are beginning to fade away because the water is just a little too warm for them to be comfortable. So we see these kinds of changes, but nature abhors a vacuum. It responds in various ways to take advantage of what are, in effect, new opportunities for warmer water creatures like scup and blue crabs and other things that benefit from the warmer temperatures. So overall, the sound is biologically as productive as ever. It's just that things are changing.
So when you, how long did it take you to do this book?
Probably from start to finish, the earliest ideas to the book actually coming out, probably about 4 years.
I mean, it's because it is a kind of encyclopedia, small, but it's an encyclopedia of a fairly large area with an incredible richness and diversity. You cover plant life, you cover insect life, reptiles, fish, shellfish. I mean, it's pretty comprehensive. Did you walk, and then also did you go on a boat in almost the entire sound? Have you been everywhere?
I don't think I've been everywhere on Long Island Sound, but it's interesting when you write a field guide that a field guide is almost an oxymoron. As you pointed out, it wants to be reasonably small so you can carry it along with you, and reasonably encyclopedic so you're going to see in the book a lot of the stuff which you see out in the environment that you happen to be in, a beach, salt marsh, or whatever. And that was really the motivation for it. This is a field guide that's not based or organized around particular animals or plants or whatever. It's organized around environments, with the notion that you could walk into a salt marsh with this book and have a reasonable chance of being able to identify all the major things that you see around you in a salt marsh and have a better understanding of how they came to be. Because if you don't know much about nature, it can seem random sometimes, but it's anything but random. Everything is there for a reason. And the motivation of the book was to try to help people not only identify the things they might see in a particular environment, say a coastal forest or a beach or a salt marsh or a rocky shore, but to also not just make a catalog of what you might see, but to hopefully give people a better understanding of why they're seeing what they're seeing.
Right. And what you will see in association with other things, which I think is important. You know, this idea of if you walk into a marsh, you begin to understand how all the pieces fit together. And I think it's hard to simplify that without leaving things out. But I thought you did a really good job of explaining the different environments so that, you know, the forest and the edge of the forest, you know, all of the pieces, the island kind of environments, all that stuff is, each one will be different. And you have to, sometimes it's hard, as you said, to know where to start looking. So the guide is really helpful in helping you frame what you're seeing and seeing how all it's also, I think, important to how all the pieces fit together. You know, I don't mean pieces in objective terms, but how all of the elements in an environment make sense.
Sure. When I was a student at Southern Connecticut State University, I had a wonderful teacher, Noble Proctor, was a very well-known, well-known birder and naturalist in New England. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. But I remember back, even in the 70s, taking an ornithology course with Noble, and his emphasizing the fact that when you see a particular bird in a particular place, you're not seeing randomness. There's a reason why that bird lives where it lives and does what it does effectively for a living. And it is all intimately related to its context, what habitat there is there, how it feeds. It may be a migrating bird which doesn't use the environment all that much over the course of a year, but for the months of migration in either spring or fall, some environments are absolutely crucial. New Haven Harbor, for example, is relatively shallow except for the shipping channel. It is mostly composed of very shallow water. People may not realize that the average depth of a place like New Haven Harbor is only a couple of feet. And so there are enormous mud flats that are exposed.
Oh, the West Haven ones.
Yeah, exactly. So around Sandy Point, there's the Sandy Point itself and then enormous mud flats that surround it. And also in places like Long Wharf, those are crucial migrating stops for shorebirds and sea ducks and other kinds of things. So even an environment which doesn't seem all that visually interesting can be really crucial to wildlife and, not incidentally, enormously productive. Even something as humble as a mudflat, that's where all the clams come from, for example.
Right.
So if you like chowder, you ought to like mudflats. And they exist all around the Sound. We've been talking mostly about the Connecticut side because in some ways we're geologically a little bit more fortunate in that for all the restrictions of private property, et cetera, we still have a relatively accessible coastline that has lots of variety in terms of headlands and bays and river mouths and things. The Long Island Sound side, I haven't been talking about so much because for about 50 to 70 miles, say the 50 miles east from Port Jefferson out to Orient Point, are a moraine, that is a giant linear pile of dirt left by the glaciers. And it has eroded away over the, say, 15,000 years since the glaciers moved out of the area. And you have effectively 50 miles of cliffs between Port Jefferson and Orient Point, with only a few low places in between, like Sunken Meadow, Wading River, a few other parks, which are spectacularly beautiful, but there aren't that many of them. There's only two natural harbors between Port Jefferson and Orient Point. So I haven't been talking as much about the Long Island Sound side, the Long Island side, the North Shore, because there are even fewer places where the public can get to those things. There are beautiful houses all along there, huge, 19th century mansions and other kinds of things. But only a few places where, say, like Kamsett State Park, where the public can go and appreciate the beauty of the sound. I'd particularly recommend Count Set in, I think it's in Huntington, Long Island. Because it's just a spectacular mix of open fields and coastal forest. And there's even a small beach dune environment out there, and also spectacular, you know, soundside cliffs. So there's a lot of beauty on the Long Island side of the Sound, but it's even less accessible in a lot of ways than on the Connecticut side.
So are there particular places? I mean, we all have our favorites, you know, places in Long Island Sound, or, you know, do you have any particular favorite spots that you tend to go to when you have the chance?
Sure. For birders and people in general who like to hike along the Sound and appreciate the natural beauty, or kayak or whatever, Hammonasset comes immediately to mind. It is the most heavily visited shoreline park. It's sort of the keystone jewel of the Connecticut coast, not just for beach going, but all year for all kinds of natural history. So it's a spectacular mix of coastal forests and beautiful beaches. And
now there's a walking trail from Hammonasset to, I don't know whether it goes all the way to New Haven yet, but there are,
the ambition for the Shoreline Trail is to go all the way from, say, Lighthouse Point all the way to Hammonasset. So elements of that are already in place. And so there's a spectacular part of the trail around Stony Creek, for example.
Yeah.
But Hammonasset, it comes immediately to mind as sort of one of the crown jewels, at least on the Connecticut side. So does Bluff Point, which is in Groton. It's a less known state park because it is, it's actually what they call a coastal reserve, so that it is not improved in any way. That is, they have beautiful beaches, but the beaches are wild. It's not raked over, which is very important for biological productivity. They have spectacular coastal forests at Bluff Point, and salt marshes, and in the place where you park, it actually starts off as a kind of brackish and even in some places freshwater river, which then transitions into Long Island Sound. So I'd highly recommend Bluff Point. It's just a gorgeous place, particularly I think of Bluff Point in the fall, because you're walking through forest for about 2 miles down to the Sound itself, and it can be just spectacularly beautiful when the leaves are turning and things. So Bluff Point.
How about Harkness up in Waterford?
Yeah, Harkness is beautiful. It is, Harkness is gorgeous because you get such spectacular wide views of things.
It's just down
a sweeping view. It's a more manicured park, so it's not quite as valuable for wildlife. It's not a huge birding destination because there's so much lawn, and there's only so many birds you're going to get on a lawn. On the other hand, it's incredibly beautiful, and if you want just a sense of the sweep of the Sound and its physical beauty of the Sound, Harkness is a great place.
So, do you go out on the water? Are you a kayaker or a canoeer?
No, I don't. In the past, I did some of that. Mostly my experience on the water these days is riding the ferries from time to time.
Which are pretty good.
Yeah, the ferry is an extraordinary experience. I'd highly recommend it. The round trip fees are not that high, and it gives you an incredible sense of the expanse of the Sound. Yeah. Long Island Sound is huge.
It's big. One of the things that's always stuck with me about the history of New Haven is that in the early colonial period, the landowners in New Haven owned satellite farms in Long Island, and they would go across the Sound on flatboats, bringing back potatoes and whatever else they were growing in Long Island to sell in the markets in New Haven. And I thought, I just found that to be stunning to think about. The distance, the amount of work, the danger because of storms. Mm-hmm. And yet they did it all the time.
Well, Long Island is a much better environment, being a lot flatter than New Haven or Connecticut coastline. So it made sense for farming to develop more on the Long Island side. But the interesting thing about the history of transport across the Sound in terms of things grown in Long Island and brought to Connecticut is there are people trying to revive that now, using the ferries, particularly as a way for, now that people value locally grown produce so much more than they used to, the locally grown stuff is mostly on the Long Island side. There are a lot of consumers on the Connecticut side, potential consumers, and so there are small startup organizations working to use the fact that the ferries go back and forth lots of times a day to bring local Long Island produce to the Connecticut area.
So if you were recommending a place for people who are interested in birds, let's say, what would you recommend as the place to go to see the most, let's say if you wanted to see as many birds as possible? Now, I know it's also seasonal. There are times of year when one place may be better than others. But if you had to, you know, for people who might be interested in birding, where would you recommend that they go?
I suspect that any Connecticut birder would automatically say Hammond Acid in the fall. Because it's a spectacular migration location. So is there are other places along the Sound. A place that's almost technically not in Connecticut, it's right on the border with Long Island, is Barn Island. It's not a heavily developed area. There's no beaches, for example, but there are spectacular salt marshes that you can walk through. There's a trail that you can walk all the way through there. Lighthouse Point in New Haven is very well known as one of the premier hawk watching sites in the fall in all of New England, not just Connecticut. The coastal forests of Kamset State Park and Long Island and Sunken Meadow can be spectacular in the fall for migration, and the spring for songbirds, particularly coming up through the coastal woodlands there. Wading River is also great, has wonderful coastal forests. And so those are the things that I think most immediately just for birds.
And one area we have not really touched on, it's kind of interesting, is the Westchester area, you know, which is an amazing spot when I think about it, as it's so close to New York, it's so populated, and yet you have in the Bronx and in Westchester some incredible places.
If you live down in the, western Long Island Sound area, you have the problems of private limited access almost to the extreme. So there's not a lot of places down there where you can go. But one place that is not only available but spectacularly beautiful is Pelham Bay Park in the Bronx. People may not think of either the Bronx as a wildlife location or Pelham Bay Park, but it's actually the largest park in New York City. It has a spectacular beach that people may know about. But in the eastern part of Pelham Bay Park, there are gorgeous what are called hardwood islands. These are rocky promontories, forested, that stick out into Long Island Sound. And they're just incredibly beautiful. I was there last fall, and it was just, you know, the trees were in such high color, even in late October, early November, that it just sort of took your breath away. It was like walking into a postcard or something. And it's the Bronx, you know? So people don't think about those kinds of things, but that natural beauty is there. The fact that the beach is closed down and it's not swimming weather anymore doesn't mean that the park evaporates.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous natural environment surrounded, you know, by the Bronx on one side and New Rochelle on the other. So it's an urban area, but within that urban area, there are incredibly beautiful wild lands.
Well, and I think you touched on one other thing there, and that is the beauty of Long Island Sound in winter. And in the, you know, the times of year when you would, it's not about swimming or, you know, beach lying in the sun on the beach, but it is about incredible and beautiful in all seasons.
I think for birders, for hikers, even for kayakers and whatnot, if you ask them what are their favorite times of year, it would probably be spring and fall. And for birders, even winter. You're not going to find a lot of bird watchers going to Hammond Acid in the middle of July because everybody else in the world is going
right.
to Hammond Acid in the middle of July. But the funny thing is that I've been, not a lot, but sometimes to Hammond Acid in the summertime. And even there, Hammond Acid's a big place. It's a lot more than just the beach. And if you're willing to, you know, park and walk the other direction, say, out into some of the hiking trails and overlooks of the salt marsh and whatnot, there may be almost literally a million people on the beach.
And there'll be nobody
but
in the...
there'll be yeah. nobody in the salt
marsh. But of course, there'll be also lots of mosquitoes.
Yes. So we do have mosquitoes, et cetera, but, you know, if you're reasonably experienced, you spray yourself up with off. And on a day with any sort of breeze at all, mosquitoes are hardly a factor.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to consider. If you go on a hot July day with no breath of wind in the air, you're going to have mosquito problems. If you go on the average July day where there's, you know, a reasonable breeze off the sound, it's not going to be much of a problem.
Well, I really want to thank you for talking to me about this book and also about Long Island Sound, which is one of my favorite places on earth. Thanks so much.
Thanks for
Patrick Lynch for talking to me about the Field Guide to Long Island Sound. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, and thank you all.